I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. It's April Fool's Day and arguably only a fool would attend a conference scheduled for today with the US Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, and not wonder how she thought UN Security Council Resolution 2728 demanding a Gaza ceasefire was not binding. All countries voted for it except the USA that has funded and armed the genocide. Critical to the propaganda narrative to enable US, UK, EU nation weapons transfer to Israel have been rape claims and beheaded babies amidst the October 7th resistance attacks by Hamas. Joining me now again on Going Underground is the son of Holocaust survivors, Professor Norman Finkelstein, known all around the world for scholarly work on the effects of Zionism. His books include Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict, The Holocaust Industry, and Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. He joins me now from New York. Thank you so much, Professor Finkelstein, for coming back on the show. It's been too long, arguably. I mean, as Gaza faces that famine, your latest piece is about October the 7th, or an analysis of October the 7th by one of Antonio Guterres's officials. How important has been the propaganda about October 7th, the use of sexual violence and beheaded babies to allow the populations of the countries of Germany, France, Britain, the United States, in arming the genocide?
There are aspects of what happened on October 7th which remain murky, and there are aspects which are fairly clear until there is an official investigation, which is the normal procedure, an international investigation which the UN wants to carry out, but which Israel refuses to allow it to carry out. We won't have, with any kind of authoritativeness, the details on what happened. Some things to me are crystal clear or beyond dispute. About 400 combatants were killed, about 800 or more civilians were killed. I don't see there's any point in arguing that Hamas and its other organizations committed massive atrocities on that day. I think it's silly to argue. Exactly how many of those 800 and some odd civilians killed, how many were killed by the militants, how many were killed in crossfire and so forth. We don't know the exact numbers, but they've got to be, you know, they've got to be significant that were killed by Hamas. I don't want to argue that. I think it's stupid. I don't even think it's particularly important. In the debate I had, you mentioned earlier before we came on air, the debate I had with Benny Morris. Benny Morris, I said, I can't tell you the numbers because I'm a stickler for figures. That's what I do in life. I'm a forensic scholar. I look for numbers. I look for evidence. And unless you give me a credible figure, I'm not going to give a number. In the debate, my partner, Muin Rabbani, he said a clear majority were killed by Hamas. Benny Morris wanted him to say overwhelming majority. Well, I don't know how you even discriminate between those two locutions, clear majority versus overwhelming majority, if we don't know the numbers.
But I mean, in fairness, Professor Finkelstein, I'm not, you know, given the scale of killing multiples since October 7th, it's the use of what we don't know, as it were, of October 7th to enable the genocide that I'm more interested in. You've called it the rape fantasies of Pramila Patten.
Yeah, I'm going to get to that in a half moment. I said I want to establish what we know, what we don't know. I said that unless you give me forensic evidence, digital evidence, I can't give you a figure. I wouldn't give a figure for anything without the forensic or digital evidence because I'm a forensic scholar. I want to see the concrete evidence. And I never thought it was important. You know, in the Nazi Holocaust, it said the official figure put out by all institutions, 6 million Jews were killed. Now, Raoul Hilberg, the best scholar on the topic, he said 5.1 million. Does it make a difference? Do we really say, oh, it was only 5.1 million? Of course not. It's completely irrelevant from the point of view of a moral judgment. From the point of view of a historical or a factual judgment, yeah, numbers count. But from a moral judgment, I said massive atrocities occurred. And that's as far as I could go without forensic evidence. Now, two of the things that were touted immediately after October 7th were the claims of beheadings and rapes. Those were the two talking points, if you will, about October 7th beyond the massacre itself. The beheadings, it seems, Israel has dropped, because if you look at the oral proceedings for the ICJ on the genocide case, when they listed the Israelis in their oral proceedings, when they listed the atrocities that occurred on October 7th, they did not include beheadings.
I should just say your old sparring partner, Alan Dershowitz of Yale, apparently picked by his friend Benjamin Netanyahu to defend Israel at the World Court, said on this program, people can watch the interview on Rumble, that not only was it skepticism was as bad as denying the Holocaust, but that he saw photographs of beheaded babies, I think.
Yeah, well, that may be what he looks at after hours at home. It may not have been from October 7th, but that's beside the point. And then there were the questions of the rapes. Now, I will admit, I was skeptical at the beginning about the systematic rapes claim. I won't go into my reasoning. It had more to do, if you'll forgive me, it had more to do with my understanding, not just of Muslim culture in general, but having a lot of young Muslim friends, a lot of my students. I know them quite well. And for reasons which I don't want to go into now, because they're personal, I was skeptical of the charge, except as maybe an isolated incident here, an isolated incident there. And then a whole controversy, as you know, unfolded about this rapes charge. And there were people who were very knowledgeable in the topic, and they were going back and forth, claiming the New York Times story was fraudulent on the case of the... It was not just the New York Times, incidentally, it was The Guardian. As my friend Jamie Stern-Weiner pointed out to me yesterday, it wasn't only the New York Times which went with that systematic rape story, it was also the British Guardian. And right now the British Guardian has their heads low. They don't want to be reminded of what they did when the Times posted that story. And then came the Pramila Patten paper. And I read it. I'm always, as I said, I'm a forensic scholar. I'm curious about evidence. And it was a very strange thing. First of all, I call it a thing because it's unclear what it was. She says, I'm not an investigator. This is not an investigative body. But then she says, I'm analyzing evidence. I'm verifying evidence, and I'm reaching not just, if you know human rights reports, are supposed to be preliminaries to a full-fledged investigation. And so the language always used is reasonable grounds to believe. That's the maximum typically a human rights report will go. We have reasonable grounds to believe this, that, and that, but they never state anything more because they haven't carried out a full-fledged legal investigation. Pramila Patten, she not only claims reasonable grounds to believe, she also claimed clear and convincing evidence. That's a much higher standard. And so now I'm shaking my head. You say you're not even an investigative body like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, or commissions mandated by the UN Human Rights Council. You say you're not even that, but you're now claiming that you have a higher standard of evidence. You claim you have clear and convincing evidence.
I mean, she's as blurry as actually your camera's going in and out of focus, but in all the decades that you've been forensically analyzing statements out of UN officials, have you ever seen anything like it in terms of where the top line at a press conference could just go out to all the news agency as there was rape?
Actually, there was one example. It was with the Mavi Marmara. After the Mavi Marmara incident, there was a big to-do between Turkey and Israel because the vessels were, the Mavi Marmara vessel, for your listeners, that was the humanitarian convoy that was going to Gaza in May 2010.
To break the blockade.
To break the blockade with humanitarian goods. And Israel attacked the vessel and then killed 9 and later a 10th person died from the attack. And Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, he was trying to figure out a way to bring about conciliation between Turkey and Israel. And he appointed this absolutely disgraceful commission called the Palmer Commission. It had on it the Colombian war criminal, Yorube was on it, and they produced a completely ridiculous report. I analyzed it in great detail in one of my books. The point being, when the Secretary General appoints a commission, a red light should go off in your head. This is not about investigation. This is about politics. And Gutierrez appointed this commission. It's not even a commission. I don't know what it is. As a sop to the United States and Israel to show he's being balanced. Because you will notice, Gutierrez was making some pretty strong statements after October 7th. I was very surprised. I thought, okay, this guy is going to be gone by Christmas. It's goodbye.
When you mean gone, you don't mean like Dag Hammarskjöld.
No, well, no, not that way. But he was being pretty tough. And I didn't see how he would last. But now I see how he would last.
So you're saying the UN Secretary General, you suspect, is the subject of a quid pro quo to allow him to continue talking about the genocide and caring anything about the civilians?
Yes, I would say that it was a political move by the Secretary General in order to show he was balanced. But it was a very strange political move. And you know why? Here's the paradox. The paradox is the Pramila Patton report ended up being the most compelling evidence that there wasn't widespread rape and sexual violence on October 7th. Now, you might be wondering, how can that be? All the media were saying, here's the proof. We have the proof. We have the smoking gun, the Pramila Patton report. But what did the Pramila Patton report show? Listen up carefully. Number one, they were supplied overwhelmingly with their evidence from the Israeli government. So you conclude, not just infer, you conclude Israel made its best case to them, correct? What was Israel's best case? They looked at not less than 5,000 photographs. And they looked at 50 full hours of digital footage. Okay? 50 full hours is not a little. That would be, if you, at max, they could have looked at it for 8 hours a day. That's, I can't see how beyond that. That's 6 full days. They were looking at this digital footage. They told us, or Patton told us, the footage came from webcams, dash cams, CCTV, traffic monitors, which is to say, they looked at footage taken from every conceivable angle.
Okay, hang on, Professor Finkelstein. We'll just go to a break now. More from one of the world's greatest Middle East scholars after this break.
Forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence or its own existence.
What is Bharat? Is it a travel ad? Is it a Bollywood poster? Is it the deepest yoga center in the world? Or is it something deeper, more complex, multifaceted? Let's talk without cliches. Let's talk Bharat.
Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Professor Norman Finkelstein, author of The Holocaust Industry and Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. Professor Finkelstein, before I interrupted, you were talking about this, well, effectively rape fantasy of a UN official, inadvertently proving that the whole of the NATO propaganda media have got it wrong about what happened on October
7th. As I was saying, They examined footage from every conceivable angle by every conceivable technological device. And you have to remember that area was abutting Gaza, which means it must have been among the most heavily surveilled areas in all of Israel. And here's the upshot, the kicker. They said in the report they couldn't find one single image or frame of sexual violence. Not one. And this was Israel's best case. Number two, if that hasn't yet sunk in, because it was a complete shock to me when I was reading it, because this is supposed to be the smoking gun proving sexual violence. Number two, they said they couldn't find a single scrap of what they called medico-legal evidence, meaning forensic evidence, of sexual violence. Not a single scrap. And then number three, they said none of the victims would step forward. Now, the usual argument is because most of them were killed, the victims. That's how the argument goes. That's not what the Patton Report said. Go look at it. It didn't say because there was an absence of direct victims. They gave the claim, they gave three kinds of claim. Number one, they said the people in that area have now been too widely dispersed throughout Israel. Number two, they claimed that these people didn't trust a UN commission. And number three, they said they were too traumatized. Well, that's just not credible.
How important is it for this Orientalism, this arguable racism against Palestinians to justify genocide and the continuing billions of dollars of weapons being sent to murder more Palestinian, 13,000 children, according to the Hamas-linked ministry? 30,000, mostly women and children, killed. Why have you written this piece about the rape fantasies of Pramila Patten? And why every other day you'll hear on mainstream propaganda media in NATO countries sexual violence as the excuse?
I haven't looked at it myself, but other people have cited this report that was done by Frank Luntz, who's a very influential analyzer of public opinion. In the U.S. And what his study showed was, pertaining to the events of October 7th, when there was asked to list which kinds of evidence have most influenced you in your support of Israel, they said number one was rape. So it was, from the point of view of public relations and galvanizing public support, it was known by them, the propagators of this claim, that it was, if we can use the words, it was the most potent weapon in their propaganda arsenal to propagate this claim. So that's, to me, the transparent reason why every time Israel faces another PR crisis, the New York Times has a new headline about the accusations of rape and sexual violence on October 7th.
Well, let's move on then to this supposed more. Maybe it is propaganda, mainstream media. I've got a paper here. Netanyahu faces crisis in U.S. relations after picking public fight with Biden. You went to school, I understand, with Chuck Schumer, the highest-ranking Democrat.
Oh, he was 3 years ahead of me in my high school.
What did you make of... I mean, he's previously said in 2010 that the people of Gaza must collectively be strangled. So you wouldn't think there's much difference between Chuck Schumer and Netanyahu when it comes to supporting genocide. And yet, if you were to read the New York Times or any of these CNN and BBC and Sky News, you'd think there's this big split between Blinken, who's been here in the Middle East. Is this manufactured, given that the arms continue to be sent to Netanyahu, or are they preparing something different ahead once they've killed all the Palestinians of Gaza?
Well, let's be clear. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer likes to be Senate Majority Leader. And an election is coming up. And President Biden wants to win that election. And the whole Democratic Party wants to win that election. And they have two problems. Or I should say they're caught between two conflicting forces. On the one hand, there is a Jewish billionaire class, and Biden wants their money. He needs their money. You know, in our country, the way you calculate the success of a campaign is how much money in campaign contributions comes in each week. They keep very close track of that number. He needs the money. In general, I won't say in every case, in general, there's been good socio-scientific research on it. There's a direct correlation between which side gets the most money in campaign contributions and who wins the election. That's the way our system works. So he needs that money. And that class, the Jewish billionaire class, has since October 7th, it's become utterly and totally ruthless in its support of Israel. There is no parallel in all of American history, I'm not just talking about modern American history, of outside individuals toppling not one, but two presidents of Ivy League universities. They toppled Claudine Gay, and then they toppled McGill in University of Pennsylvania. They are ruthless now. Gay and McGill were toppled because they were insufficiently repressive and suppressive of dissent on their campuses. And Biden knows one false move, and they'll just give their money to Trump. They'll just switch. So he has to keep sending the weapons.
But what if they then ask him to go, like Israel tried to get the United States and its allies to go to war in Iraq after 9/11? I mean, does that mean they could persuade them for an attack on Iran because it's an election
year?
No,
I don't agree with that. I have a different opinion of that. I've studied that quite closely. That was a decision made by Rumsfeld and Cheney. That was not an Israeli decision. Actually, the Israelis wanted us back then to go after Iran, not Iraq. So I don't think they played a
critical
role.
Could they do it this time?
Well, however, there is a critical point here in what you're saying. Senator Schumer and Robert Menendez were the only two Democratic Party main senators who opposed the Iran deal out of loyalty to Israel. And now it's Schumer, that same Schumer who opposed the Iran deal, And the same Schumer who, as you correctly quoted in 2010, said we should economically strangle Gaza. That's what he said. It's the same Schumer who gave that speech. And that's why I said there are two forces that are caught between the Jewish billionaire class and the Democratic Party base. And there's a lot of turbulence, not to mention outrage, in the Democratic Party base at the support of the Biden administration for the de facto support of the Biden administration for Israel, the enabling, it's not just support, enabling Israel. And so Schumer, it was a very interesting speech. It was very interesting. First of all, he named four obstacles to peace. One, Hamas. Two, the Palestinian Authority. Three, Netanyahu. And four, the far right in Israel. He balanced the responsibility. Very unusual. Especially, he's the guy who opposed the Iran deal. I mean, he's like way out in right field. He balanced. And then the most interesting part of the speech was he didn't say supporting one state was anti-Semitic. He actually said, if you read the speech, he said, I understand the idealism of young people who want one state and don't see what's wrong with one state. He then proceeded to try to rationally refute the demand for one state, but he did not dismiss it out of hand.
Okay, Professor, but we're just running out of time. But as you say, that's the first time I think one state is back on the agenda. But in the last 2 minutes, Blinken, of course, who's been in this region, talking about some sort of pier. It was previously mooted by an Israeli transport secretary. Could the U.S. military be involved in this region off the coast of Gaza with a pier?
No, this whole thing is such a disgraceful public. You know, every president running for office, of course, they're going to engage in PR. But to engage in PR when children are starving to death in the most literal sense, everybody with an ounce of knowledge will tell you there is no need for a pier. There are hundreds of trucks outside Gaza which are waiting to enter. The problem is not material capacity. The problem is not even logistics. The problem is exactly as the EU foreign policy chief said, quote, Israel is using starvation as a weapon. Let's not pretend, as the New York Times did, that this is a technical question of how to get the food and medicine to the people in Gaza. This is not a technical question. This is a political question. There is a siege imposed on Gaza to starve the population to death unless Hamas surrenders. That's the problem.
Professor Norman Finkelstein, thank you. And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by UK-US EU-armed bombing in Palestine, Lebanon, Yemen, Syria and Iraq. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.